Hello and welcome to Books on the Go, a podcast where we talk about our book of the week. I'm Anna Bailey-Karras and I'm here with Annie Waters. Hi, Annie.
Hello.
And apologies for our absence. We thought Annie had COVID.
It's me again. Yeah. Another, my second in a month of isolating, but I didn't get it.
So, and we think Annie might be super immune. And this week we have been reading The Candy House by Jennifer Egan. But first, book news. And there have been a few things obviously happening while we've been gone. One of them is the Women's Prize shortlist has been announced, which is always exciting. And the six shortlisted books are Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead, Sorrow and Bliss by Meg Mason, The Book of Form and Emptiness by Ruth Ozeki, The Bread the Devil Need by Lisa Allen Agostini, The Island of Missing Trees by Elif Shafak, and The Sentence by Louise Erdrich.
And it's the first time ever I've read five out of the six.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so but just incidentally.
I was very excited that I'd read four out of the six. So which have you read? Ruth Ozeki as well?
Yeah, which I didn't love. So yeah, my picks I think from last time are still the same. The Sentence or The Island of Missing Trees are my picks to win. Having not read The Bread the Devil Need, who knows, that might be the dark horse.
Yeah, I was going to say it's just The Bread the Devil Need that we might need to read.
I can do the sextuplet.
The six, the whole lot. It'll be so interesting to see who wins. They're all, I can see all of them potentially being a winner for different reasons. Yeah. Well, other than the two that I haven't read. But like you, I just loved The Sentence and I love The Island of Missing Trees. And also in women's writing, in Australia, the Stella Prize winner has been announced. Mm-hmm. Drum roll.
Yes, so it is the first year that poetry has been allowed in the prize. So it's previously been for fiction and nonfiction by women and non-binary writers. And this year they've allowed poetry and lo and behold, a poet. Poem collection has won. Wow. So Drop Bear is by Evelyn Araluen, who's an Aboriginal Australian woman. And yeah, it's a collection looking at colonialisation and the ongoing effects of that today. It's beautiful and funny and wry and she's great. I love her a lot. She's probably only in her, she's younger than me, she'd be in her early 30s or late 20s and she's a real powerhouse.
Oh, fantastic. I must say I've seen that in the shops and I haven't read it yet. So this has prompted me to pick it up, which the Stella Prize often does.
Either, but I'll have to now.
I've heard that it is really good. Mm. So that is the news. And there was one other piece of news on the local front, Annie.
Yes. So we as Australians are very excited and also as Adelaideans because Pip Williams, who's the author of The Dictionary of Lost Words, is the first Australian person to be chosen by Reese Witherspoon's book club, which is, you know, such an illustrious designation. But really, it does wonders for sales. So yeah, I think it bodes really well and gives her an international platform that she really deserves.
And I really must read the book now.
Yeah, Anna still hasn't read it. And I don't know, maybe it's gone too far. Maybe it's one of those ones where you're like, the hype has gone beyond. Oh, no. I can't even.
I think that was the issue. It was so hyped. And for whatever reason, I didn't read it straight away. I can't remember. And it was then so hyped that I was nervous about reading it and then I nearly read it but I lent it to someone instead and so I don't even have it now. And
maybe it'll be one of those books that you pick up in 5 years' time, you're like, oh, this is really good.
I know. Well, exactly. And then I'll be kicking myself that I didn't read it earlier. Anyway, read it.
You can't read them all.
Listeners, let us know if you've read The Dictionary of Lost Words and we'll stay tuned for the movie, which we think.
A customer favourite at our shop.
Oh, yeah. It must be. Mm. It must be. It's that sort of book that I think people just recommend wide and far. Yeah. So on to our book of the week, The Candy House by Jennifer Egan.
Yes. So Jennifer Egan has written six novels, including A Visit from the Goon Squad, which won the Pulitzer and the National Book Critics Circle Award. And that was about 12 years ago now. And then she wrote Manhattan Beach 4 or 5 years ago, which won the Andrew Carnegie Medal. She's also had a short story collection called Emerald City. She was the president of the Pen America Center, and she's also worked as a journalist and has been highly awarded for her work there. In college, she dated Steve Jobs, and he installed a Microsoft computer in her home.
I did not know that.
No, I didn't know that either. And I was
That makes so much sense.
It does. It does. Yeah, I was just cruising her Wikipedia and that fact jumped out at me. Mm. So that's fascinating. And then the other little tidbit that I have about her, I heard her speak at the Sydney Writers Festival a few years ago. And she was talking to Min Jin Lee, who wrote Pachinko.
Yes.
And they were talking about their styles of kind of editing and drafting and all of that. And she says she writes up to 20 drafts and she will ditch. She'll just delete. She writes longhand and she will just get rid of it. She'll write the draft, she'll get rid of it, and then she'll write the book again. And it's,
I think I've heard this.
Yeah.
And does she liken it to building a house?
Yeah,
or
pretty
building
much. You need to kind of make the world. And then the other thing that she said that really stayed with me was that she wants her books to be surprising. And so she kind of makes a list of all the possibilities of the ways that a certain situation could go, and then she throws all of those out too. So it has to surprise even her. And it's kind of like she really wants to tap into this unconscious or this kind of, she doesn't want to be cliche to the point of extremity, which I think makes for an amazing book. And it's an incredible demonstration of the rigor that you need to be a writer at this level. I mean, Manhattan Beach took her 6 or 7 years to write. She was doing all of this research and then integrating it into a draft and then throwing the draft out the window, which that for me is the thing. How can you do that? It's like throwing one of your children out the window. But
that's why her books feel so fresh, because they're not the same words that have been whittled and worked on and crafted to within an inch of their life so that they're then dead by the time you read it. It's because that's gone out of the window and then it's the fresh new words.
Totally.
That
and
have
it's such a refreshing
come to us.
Perspective on writing, that writing is not actually the words that end up on the page so much as the ideas and the characters and the scenery that drives that. And once you've got those things in your head, then the writing must surely just flow out.
Well, it probably does for Jennifer Egan.
Yes. If you've won the Pulitzer Prize and among many other prizes, then perhaps that's how it works. But yeah, I'd be keeping it all in a draft document just in case I needed to put them all back in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so this book, The Candy House, is actually quite hard to describe because it's a nominal follow-up to A Visit from the Goon Squad, which has been described as a polyphonic novel, as a very meta novel, and that and this both have multiple different characters all in the same world who are tangentially related to each other, and each chapter or section is narrated by one of those characters across time, across space, across kind of modes of thought. And there is some experimentation in terms of the forms that she uses. So one of the sections in this novel is told through an email exchange. One of them's told through a woman who's working as a spy, kind of writing field notes to herself. But this one I felt wasn't quite as experimental as Visit from the Goon Squad, which I read 10 years ago. But my memory is that felt more experimental in terms of the form. But it follows roughly. There's a man called Bix who is, I guess, a Steve Jobs type character who has invented, or at the very beginning of the novel, is just about to invent a method of uploading your consciousness, your memories to the cloud, basically. And it's called Own Your Unconscious. So it's very Matrix-like. You kind of plug in all these little nodes to your head and then you lie back and think about nothing or everything for 4 or 5 hours, and then eventually your thoughts will be captured and you can share one moment or many. And the book then looks at the repercussions of that technology and the ways that it fractures families and all the different people in this world react differently to it. And I guess it's looking at how online we are now and how we find connection and whether that connection is authentic and valuable and the dangers of sharing too much of yourself
because
in an online space.
They can share that, can't they? So it's sort of like Facebook or Instagram but with your thoughts.
Yes.
Which is
quite a
scary confronting
concept. Yeah. So I think initially it just starts as you can record it and play it back like an old VHS or something like that. But then as the technology develops, you can share and upload to the cloud, and a condition of getting the box that helps you record your whole memory is that you upload part of it. So it kind of is on a Facebook level buy-in scheme. You need to commit something in order to watch everyone else's.
You're giving them your data.
Yes,
basically.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
So what did you think?
I loved it. Great. Absolutely loved it. I just inhaled it. I couldn't put it down. Mm. It's and for a number of reasons. Why is this a book that you keep turning the page? Mm. It's always interesting to think about. The story is fun. So there's that sense of fun and playfulness in the story. The characters leap off the page, and maybe that's that freshness that we were talking about, that she's already written 20 other versions and then this is they're sort of fully formed by the time she gets to this draft. And her sense of humour is really, really good. Mm. And it's just all the way through. It runs through every different section in different ways. I think there's one scene where there's one family where he's a rock star or a record producer, and then I think his wife dies. It's a bit hazy. I think his wife dies and one of the children's narrating this section, and they said, and then finally we had to get in some family counselling, and the family counsellor was this completely nerdy, really awkward guy who all of us hated, and it was the first time in a long time we'd seen my father laugh, and you know, we just had to get rid of the family therapist, and you know, everything just has a sense of fun about
it. There's joy in it.
And that's mm. only one sentence. Mm. You know, that whole scene, yeah. that whole part of their lives, for example, was only two lines mm. in the book, but she gives you so much. So that I think that's why it's really propulsive mm. because there's this pace that it's yeah. always moving. There's always so much happening. Mm. And
I actually found that almost really overwhelming. Mm. And maybe that's part of it, that everyone has a story going on all the time, all around you, and that you actually can't know more than maybe one or two of them at a time before you get totally yeah. overwhelmed. And I also found, I read this book probably a month and a half ago, I had remembered the themes and some of the characters, but there's just far too many characters. I remember even in yeah, reading it, I couldn't
true.
Make all the connections. I just couldn't put together whose niece is this and who is – and also because it links back to Goon Squad,
mm.
I could pick up a few of those connections from my very hazy memory of that book. But I don't think you need to have read that to read this and enjoy it.
No.
But it was overwhelming in some sense. If you're the kind of reader who needs to know who everyone is and pin down how they're each interconnected, I think it's going to be really tricky read.
And I can't imagine how Jennifer Egan
oh my
had
God,
that
no.
all in her head. But you're right, it is too many characters to really keep on top of in mm. detail. But I think that's also partly why she must have that structure where mm. each character has a really distinct voice. So there's the one who works in the computer company.
Mm, Leonard.
I call it computer company. Yeah. The one who's a counter or a he's got a very maths mm. brain, and his voice is extremely he was quite robotic.
All the algorithms that he was trying to work out.
He was yeah. all into the algorithms but wasn't, you know, struggled a bit more socially, mm. but his voice is really distinctive. And then, of course, as you say, the field notes mm. And the email exchange. Mm. So everyone, at least that helps you sort of differentiate
yeah. I think
who you're looking
you're
at.
You're totally in whoever's story you're reading at the moment, and I think that's part of it too, that you can kind of just get plucked out of one person's world and plonked down in another, and you believe it and you go with it, and you think after the first three lines you think, oh yeah, I know where we are, I know what's going mm. on, and I'll go with it. You
and
just
it's
trust
the same,
her.
It's the same world.
Yes,
and it's
but
all,
I mean, you know, small sphere.
It's integrated, mm. so they all connect. They do connect. You, mm. I did have a sense the whole way through that they were all connected
yes.
to each other. The characters were interacting with each other, even though sometimes you've forgotten
mm.
that he, you know, at one point Chris, and then, oh, that's right, and his father was Benny, mm. and then you remember, oh, that's right, and mm. Benny was the one who helped them when their father died, and they, the two girls, rose
yes.
up through yep. the whatever. I don't plot spoiler anyway.
But it's, there's not really a capital
it's
P
really
plot,
a, no,
you know. It's
no,
not about
true.
The plot. It's more about the experience, I think, of reading it and then
yeah.
the ideas that it leaves you with.
Yeah. So I was a bit like you in the sense that I just loved reading it, and it just brings that joy of reading back again. And it's a delight to read. And then after I finished it, I couldn't necessarily tell you much
mm.
about it. About
it. I started writing my notes this morning and trying to just map all the characters, and it quickly became half the page, and I just thought, okay, that's too much. I can't get into any of them. But the things that did come up were actually not things that I'd been thinking about while I was reading it, but all of the families in this book are fractured in some way. You know, there's either a parent leaves or a parent dies, while the children are still quite young. And I think it looks at the ways that fractured families and fractured relationships in especially young people's lives affects people so, so differently. So I found that an interesting theme that came out that I hadn't thought about while I was reading it.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that came out was kind of, and I think this I was thinking about while I was reading it, was authenticity and reality and what, how do we know that what we experience is real, and to what extent is memory or your memory of something the real truth, and how can you approach that most accurately? And I think, yeah, she kind of comes down on the side of, well, you can't quantify it. Even if you could put your memories in the cloud, that doesn't make it,
no,
that doesn't make it any closer to the reality of that moment for you, you
but
know?
Also it's almost a nice concept that your memories of a lot of events will be connected with someone else's memories if you shared an event together, and they'll be different but they'll sort of connect
like a tapestry
they'll connect with each other. So there was one which I think Bix was involved in where one of them couldn't remember, there was what just one part of the day that he wanted access to that he couldn't remember, but one of his friends would remember that, and so between them they have a sort of a collective so there's a sense of collectiveness to it. But it's interesting as well, you talk about the families, that maybe she's saying the events are not so important, but it's the relationships you have with the people around you or your family that is what you remember.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't
know. And I think also that no one's beyond redemption. Like, lots of the characters have had a traumatic incident in their life or have made a bad decision, and it's, you often see them after that point or long after, when they've made peace with their demons or they've really succumbed to some kind of addiction or, you know, fallen into that hole. I think, yeah, she's got such a generous way of dealing with her characters that no one is evil, you know, no one's totally bad and no one's totally good either, but it's a very realistic way of looking at people and a very wholehearted, warm-hearted way of...
They just make mistakes, but rather than being good or bad. It reminded me a little bit of David Foster Wallace in the sense that, partly because it's almost a series of monologues, which is like Infinite Jest, and just that humour, and it's slightly far-fetched, like everything, it's over the top in terms of what happens, and I mean even the premise of course, but just the way that she takes everything to the extreme and in that similar way that he does, but makes it funny and it's got that energy to it.
It's very vital, you know, like it's all the things in life, the good and the bad, and it's, everyone will have had an experience that's similar to one of these experiences, and I guess that's what she's trying to approach, that we're all humans and we're all living in the same world and it's not perfect, but what else do we have, you know?
Yeah, so it's that thing of getting caught up in that crisis that that character's facing at that time, which could be anything. So it's almost like she'll give them a jumping off point. And for example, in the Goon Squad, it was, is it Dolly or the PR person? And she'd had this big party and she'd had candles all in the, I can't remember exactly, but all the hanging lanterns from the ceiling, but then they all spilt and covered everyone with burning oil. And it was the most disastrous PR launch in history. So 700
so
people
to the country X,
and you start sort of just just from that one point of Dolly has to organize a big party, she runs off to the point where 700 people are in intensive care or whatever, you know. That character reappears in the candy house, and I'd forgotten all about that.
That was the one character that I could remember from Goon Squad.
And I don't remember, I read Goon Squad and I don't remember, I remember that I loved it. I don't remember what happened, a bit like maybe this one will be in 12 years' time. But, and so there's a debate, or not a debate, but some readers have said, do you need to read Goon Squad before you read The Candy House? And some people are rereading Goon Squad to sort of get ready.
I'm tempted to now, reread it afterwards.
But I had forgotten so much of it that it's almost as if I hadn't read it. And so I don't, I'm here to say I don't think you need to have read it.
No,
and probably
definitely not required reading.
If you read it just before The Candy House, it would give you all sorts of, there'd be all sorts of little Easter egg, little
Well, it would be
surprises.
Like reading just one long novel, I think.
Yeah.
Because they do, they're all in the same world. Some of the characters reappear It's interesting. I can't remember as many of the themes or the ideas in Goon Squad, and I think that was more for me about the experimentation and the taking the novel to a different form. Like, I remember one person who was on the autism spectrum who wrote his section entirely in PowerPoint. That's the one that stayed with me. And then Kiki and Dolly, these crazy celebrities who go off to some strange South American country and get involved with a dictator.
Yeah.
Those are the stories that I remember. But it's funny because she wrote a novel in between, Manhattan Beach, which is so different to both of these novels and is such a story and is such – the characters are so well-rounded, and that's really integral. It's more traditional.
That was historical fiction, wasn't it? I read that one.
It was beautiful. So, yeah, she's just an incredible writer, really. I think she can do anything.
It feels like she can do anything. There's a real mastery in the writing.
It reminded me of David Mitchell, you know, that Cloud Atlas kind of just totally bird's eye view of this whole world, and you can just pluck into any of the different streams that are happening and they'll know exactly what's going on. It's not the way my brain works at all. I cannot imagine how much planning she had to do.
I can't, but she must really enjoy that experimentation and that playing with the form.
And I imagine they feel real to her, you know. That I don't think you can do this without just imagining them all living around you.
Absolutely. Oh, no, I really loved it. I'm recommending. So
great. I'm glad.
That was The Candy House by Jennifer Egan. And next week we're not sure, but what we might do soon is some comfort reading recommendations for anyone who is also isolating or just wants a good book.
Or cozying up for the Australian winter.
Cozy Australian winter books. Yeah. So we'll come back to you with those and send us any of your recommendations. And in the meantime, you can follow us on Facebook at Books on the Go. You can email us booksonthegopodcast@gmail.com. And I'm on Instagram, Twitter and Litzy at A. Bailey Karras. And Annie?
I'm on Instagram, Twitter and Litzy very occasionally at Mr. _Annie.
Lovely. We'll see you next week. Bye for now. Bye.